welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP, Chapel Hill, and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our past programs at radioinvivo.net. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences and research. For more than 25 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Hamner for its support. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And last but not least, Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. Well, this week on Radio In Vivo, we are going to continue our look at the scientific side of music. Last week, we learned all about a remarkable new recording technology being pioneered by a company in Raleigh. This week, we're going to hear about some fascinating research into the effects of music on the human brain. And we're going to take one of our rare ventures outside the Triangle as we welcome the director of the Music Research Institute at UNC Greensboro to our Radio In Vivo microphones today. Dr. Donald Hodges is Covington Distinguished Professor of Music Education, as well as Director of the Music Research Institute at UNCG. Don oversees nearly 30 research projects at the Institute, and we're going to hear about many of them on the program this morning. He has authored more than 100 book chapters, papers, and multimedia programs in music education and music psychology. He holds degrees from the University of Kansas and the University of Texas, including his PhD. Don and his work came to my attention recently because in September, he delivered a lecture at the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh as part of the museum's Wild Music series entitled A Layman's Guide to the Musical Brain. Don, thank you so much for making the trek from Greensboro to Carrboro this morning and joining us on Radio In Vivo.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Don, to get us started, why don't you fill us in a little bit on the Music Research Institute itself that you direct over there at UNCG. I know that UNCG has long had one of the best collegiate music programs in the country, but what does the research arm do?
Well, the Music Research Institute is designed to study music and the human experience as broadly as that. In essence, that vague description allows us to do and explore any direction we want to. Currently, we are divided into about seven different fields. We have a biomusic unit, which the museum exhibit that you mentioned was part of that. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Patricia Gray, who runs that program, is also researching musicality in bonobo apes, who are our highest primate cousins. And she's also just received, along with David Teachout, one of our other faculty members, an NSF grant to train elementary music and science teachers to teach in an integrated fashion, both music and science together. So that's the Biomusic Project. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of neuroimaging work on music in the brain, which we'll be talking about shortly. We do a series of studies on music-related hearing loss, in which we're investigating the effects of musicians spending many, many hours per day and a good portion of their lives in rather noisy environments. So in a practice room, in a teaching studio, in an ensemble. And we're looking at aspects like tinnitus and things like a genetic basis for music-related hearing loss. It seems as if certain individuals are protected against hearing loss and others that have a predisposition for it. So we're trying to ferret out all of that. We also do studies in ethnomusicology. That's the look of that's a study of music in different societies around the world, and in particular, Gavin Douglas looks at the music of Myanmar or Burma. And you know, since that country was just recently in the news, that you can see very quickly the role that music plays in a political sense. For example, we've known through in societies throughout the history that when a totalitarian government takes over, almost one of the first things they do is to squelch free expression, and music is one of the most potent of those. So that happened in Iran, Iraq, and China when the Red Guard took over. And
Afghanistan.
Afghanistan with Khomeini. And so certainly now in Burma, you're seeing the role of music as it either does or does not express people's wish to be free and to have a human experience that's creative. We do a number of experiments, as you would imagine, in a school of music, in music-related performance.
Sure.
And studying various aspects. Certainly the hearing loss is part of all that, but also we're looking at various ways to understand and to improve teaching and learning of music and various ways that, in many, many respects, learning music is a 19th century phenomenon. That is, the way you learn to play the violin probably isn't much different than it was several hundred years ago, in certain respects, that is.
Sure.
And yet we're trying to look at different ways where we can not do away with any of the valuable things we've learned in those couple of hundred years, but can we add new technologies? Can we add new insights from science? And then, of course, we do quite a bit in music education. One of our projects is called Sounds of Learning, the Impact of Music Education. And we are doing a series of experiments around the country looking at what difference does it make if a child gets a quality music education. And in this project, we've funded about 11 different major projects at universities like Florida State, University of Illinois, University of Kansas, Arizona State, Columbia Teachers College. And these universities, we've funded them to the tune of about $750,000 so far, which in the sciences is just a drop in the bucket. But in the arts and in education, that's a pretty hefty commitment.
Sure.
So, again, we have a variety of things going on at any one time, and my role is to sort of be the field manager for all that.
Great. Well, I certainly want to talk in some detail about many of those studies you've just mentioned. But why don't we start with some of your work involving brain imaging and music.
Okay.
I understand you've discovered some very interesting differences between the neural structures of musicians and non-musicians.
That's correct. The first thing I want to make a little personal comment about the word non-musician. You see that word in the literature all the time, and it can be used appropriately so, but I want to make sure that when I use the word non-musician, it does not connote a person who is not musical. What it really connotes is somebody who does not have formal training. And I say that because one of the things we've learned from brain research is that all human beings are musical, that we are wired to be musical creatures very much in the same way that we're wired to be linguistic creatures. So that if you take a very, very large cross-section of human beings, virtually all of them will be able to use language to some degree in some capacities. At the low end of the scale, some may have limited abilities. And at the high end, you may have somebody like a Shakespeare who has an extraordinary command of language, but all people are language users, barring massive dysfunction.
Sure.
And that's true musically as well. So, now back to your question. It's very clear that when we study adult musicians who have formal training and those who have not had formal training, even though they might enjoy music and like to listen to it and so on, that there are very definite differences in brain structures. This is actually true of anything. Anything you do as a human being actually will modify the brain. That's a definition of learning.
Right.
And so we're not claiming, at least I'm certainly not claiming, that musical training makes the brain better necessarily or makes you smarter necessarily. There was a whole cottage industry of music makes you smarter that maybe we can talk about later.
Sure.
But certainly it does change brain structures in response to musical training. An example of that would be if you look at musicians who started studying seriously before the age of 7, the corpus callosum, which is the band of fibers that connects the left and right hemispheres and helps the two work together in an integrated fashion, the corpus callosum of trained musicians has millions more fibers than those who are not trained. But again, it's not magic. What that really comes from, and some of this is speculation because we haven't actually imaged kids before the age of 7, although they're beginning to do that now, but that study is underway. It comes from the fact that most students or most adult musicians who started studying that earlier most likely play either the piano or a stringed instrument, like a Suzuki program.
Right, right.
And you simply can't play the piano or the violin effectively unless the two hands cooperate with each other.
Sure.
So when you force those hands to cooperate over a period of time, then, in fact, the brain responds in that way.
Mm. Neural pathways.
That's right. And I strongly suspect that if we looked at a child, for example, who grew up in a circus family and he started juggling at the age of 4 and continued to juggle as an adult, I suspect we might see, you know, similar sort of response. So corpus callosum would be one example. Certainly the auditory cortex, primary hearing, seat of hearing discrimination. We know that the auditory cortex, primary auditory cortex of trained musicians is about 130% larger and considerably more sensitive and responsive to discriminating sounds than untrained. And there are a number of other that we could go through a catalog, I suppose. But yes, we certainly can catalog some of the difference between trained and untrained musicians.
So those neural differences, they actually make a lot of sense in terms of the skills that trained musicians...
Sure, absolutely. One of the things that we're working on right now, as a matter of fact, I collaborate with some folks at the Wake Forest School of Medicine in their Advanced Neuroscience Imaging Lab. And we've looked at trained conductors, musical conductors, that is, and paired them with people of the exact same age, the exact same education and training, same handedness and the same gender ratio. So we have the same number of males and females because their brains are slightly different, and handedness does make a difference. So if you control for all those things and the signal difference is in musical training or not, we know outside the brain scanner that these trained musicians are much better at making auditory discrimination tasks. Not only are they better, but they're much, much faster. But if you give them visual tasks, sort of an equivalent visual task, they're not necessarily better at all. The surprise comes, however, when you give them what are called multisensory tasks, which asks what happens when you compare or when you combine auditory and visual information. So now what we've seen is that the musicians get a benefit from this multisensory interaction that they've never found in any other group. And in fact, when you look carefully at the untrained folks, they actually have to shut off the visual information and ramp up the auditory information in order to really focus on the sounds, where the conductors don't have to do that. And it makes sense that if you're on the podium in front of, let's say, an 85-piece orchestra, and somebody plays a wrong note, you have to know immediately who did that and where it came from.
Right.
So you both use both auditory and visual information in an extremely rapid response system. And if you do that over enough years, obviously it stands to reason that the brain has reorganized itself to do that very well.
Well, you mentioned about kids who juggle from an early age, and it seems like the differences that you're talking about would be, to a great extent, likely to show up in other people with high levels of training in a given field that requires coordination of the intellect and the body. Mm-hmm. Surgeons comes to mind.
Sure, absolutely.
Have you looked at anything in those realms?
No, that's outside our purview, and I'm not really familiar with that particular kind of literature, but it absolutely makes good sense that, again, virtually anything you do repetitively and over long periods of time, the brain would respond to that. Now, one of the interesting questions that one might ask is, you know, are there separate neural networks for each particular kind of discipline, or are there shared networks? And the most common literature in this area would be in music and language. Mm-hmm. And it turns out so far, and of course the answers change every year as we get more and more information, but right now it turns out that there are really three circumstances. You can clearly demonstrate that that language and music are dissociated, that is, that the neural networks for the two of them are separated.
Okay.
You can show that there are very nearby shared sub-areas of a similar larger region. So they're next door to each other, but not necessarily overlapping. And then you can show that there are overlapping regions where the same part of the brain is subserving both language and music. So I would imagine that if you look at surgeons, whom you mentioned, that again, we would find some distinctly unique neural networks for some particular things that they might have to do, but obviously other networks would be shared with other physical motoric actions.
Sure. So what is the data showing us? What is the end purpose to imaging the brains of musicians?
Well, there are really two parts to that question. It's a very common one, and it's not a quick and easy answer. The short answer is that we're doing both basic and applied research. Basic mm-hmm. research is simply trying to find out what's going on without an immediate purpose in mind.
Sure.
And unless and until we do that, we really won't be able to make good applications. So the applied research, the things that we actually want to do for a particular purpose, rest very heavily on good, solid, basic research. And you can see that in language and in other areas, other domains. But we haven't had that sort of that backlog of information built up over time. So that's the first purpose, simply is to understand, well, how does this thing work? What's going on in there?
Right.
Oddly enough, musicians and neuroscientists, and again, I'm a musician, I want to be very clear to the listeners that, you know, all my training and expertise is in music, and I work collaboratively with neuroscientists. If I'm in a room full of musicians, I probably do know more about the brain than most of them, but if I'm in a room of neuroscientists, I'm very definitely an amateur, and I recognize that clearly. But when we work together as teams, what's apparent is that we want to learn, that is, musicians want to learn about music in the brain for, let's say, musical reasons and purposes. Mm-hmm. Ironically, they're actually interested in using music as a window into the brain because they can learn some things about the brain they couldn't get through language and through mathematics and through other domains. So when we pair together, we can do the same study and both of us learn something on either side.
So you make beautiful music together.
Well, we hope so. Now, in terms of the applied, there's some very direct and powerful things that are already going on, but I think we're just barely scratched the surface. We haven't even seen the tip of the iceberg yet. One example would be a colleague of mine by the name of Michael Tout, who's both a music therapist and a neuroscientist at Colorado State University. And he works with Parkinsonian and stroke patients in neurologic rehabilitation. And he basically trains or retrains these patients, these individuals, to walk and to reach and to grasp, for example, to pick up a cup of coffee and drink, or to use a spoon and get some soup, by using what he calls rhythmic auditory stimulation. And essentially what he's doing is using the motor systems of the brain who are already harnessed up to the auditory systems. We know that there's a strong linkage between what we hear and how we move. You see that right now. As I'm talking to you, your head is nodding and moving.
Right, and your hand is moving.
That's right. So when you watch two people in deep conversation, you see a ballet, actually.
Sure.
And the people have studied that interaction. And oddly enough, some illnesses are diagnosed through arrhythmia, through people who do not interact in a motoric, rhythmic fashion with the people that they're in contact with. And so what Michael's done is taken advantage of that, and he essentially, now it's not as simple as saying he plays some music and they learn to walk again, but in fact, in a very much more complex and systematic way, that's exactly what's happening. He's retraining the firing patterns of the motor system to respond to the rhythmicity of the music in such a way that over time, they actually can regain these skills. And in a midpoint, they sort of march to the music, if you will.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And later on, they have an internal clock that's been reset, if you will, by this rhythmic aspect.
It sounds very much like what you see in nursery school and kindergarten.
Sure.
With all the kids with the rhythm instruments.
Absolutely, yeah.
And learning those motor skills.
Because the body is actually wired to be that way, we can learn to take advantage of that. Another example would be that, and I'll say very quickly, we're just now even beginning to think about what ways we might do it. But one of the areas they study in at the Wake Forest School of Medicine Imaging Department is dyslexia. Mm-hmm. And we've known for some time two anecdotal things, and we hope to put a third piece to that puzzle and see if we can move it forward. One thing is that dyslexia seems to be as much a timing problem, that is, again, a rhythmicity problem, as it is a transposition of letters and so on. Because reading, for example, is a timed event, you read across time, it stands reason, although people wouldn't think about it that way, that there is a rhythmic aspect, or a timing aspect, certainly, to the aspect of reading. And we also know that music therapists can be very effective in working with dyslexic individuals. And now one of the things that we've just submitted a grant for funding, we'll see if we get funded, is to put an imaging piece with this and see if, in fact, the long-term goal would be, if you train a dyslexic child, give them musical training, can they, in fact, improve their reading skills as a result of this retraining of the rhythmic timing aspect of reading?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A clearer example that the public would recognize is in Mel Tillis, a country western singer who stutters very profusely when he speaks,
sure.
And yet he sings flawlessly. And there are many examples of stutterers who can, in fact, sing fluently.
Sure.
Melodic intonation therapy is another example of a technique that's used with aphasic patients. Patients who have a stroke, Broca's aphasia, where they can't speak, can sometimes be retrained to sing what they want to say, and over time that gets modulated. So they have a little bit of a sing-song speech, but they're really retraining neural pathways. And that speaks to the earlier question that shows, first of all, the dissociation, that the music neural network might be preserved, but it also shows the linkage, because if they were totally separated, you couldn't get from music to language.
Right.
But the fact that they can sing fluently, then you could retrain, so they basically could learn to speak using that pitch pattern, in this case, and rhythmicity, shows again that there are some connections at deeper levels. So in Parkinson's, in dyslexics, in stutterers, those are three very clear examples of possible applications. Alzheimer's disease is another very clear example. If this were television, I could show you a video clip of an Alzheimer's patient who was a piano teacher in her earlier days. And at the beginning of this video clip, she tries to speak, but it's absolutely speaking incoherently. You wouldn't understand a single word she says.
Mm-hmm.
And while she's speaking, she's seated in a wheelchair at a piano keyboard, and she's trying to speak. And off camera, somebody begins to hum a familiar children's tune. And within half a second, her hands strike the keyboard and play exactly the correct pitch that matches what the person was singing, and she instantly begins to play with both hands this familiar tune.
Wow.
And in fact continues for some time after that, improvising and playing. So the musical grammar, if you will, is completely intact.
Still there.
Even mm-hmm. though she can't speak about it. And so but we don't understand exactly how and why all that works. And again, harnessing, so the basic research will eventually give us enough information to explain. It's not magic. It's mysterious because we don't understand it. But it's not magic. There's something going on. What is it going? How do we do that? And can we harness that in very particular ways? Music medicine is another very clear application where there's an organization called International Society for Music Medicine,
mm-hmm.
and the executive director of that, Ralph Spintke, is an anesthesiologist in Lüdenscheid, Germany. Works in a very large hospital. They do thousands of surgeries a year, and he's got data on 160,000 surgical and pain patients over many, many years. And he can, in fact, reduce drug dosage nearly half in certain clinically prescribed situations by using music instead.
In terms of analgesics.
Right. So it turns out that when we listen to music, there is an effect on blood chemistry. Actually, there are a whole host of physiological responses, obviously things like heart rate change, breathing rate change, and motor responses, tapping your foot, nodding your head, and so on.
Sure.
But included in all that are these changes in biochemicals, things like endorphins, cortisol, interleukin, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've been learning to do over many years is to harness that. So playing certain pieces of music to control these substances such that you can reduce the drug dosage. And clearly there are advantages when you don't have toxic or adverse reactions to music that you might to drugs.
Unless it's Barry Manilow.
That's right. It could be if that's the music you don't prefer. And in many cases, if you go through a surgical procedure or have an anesthetic, getting over the anesthetic is almost as bad as the getting over the surgery, in which case,
sure,
when the music stops, it's not still there in the system. So
right.
This is another example where we haven't yet done the brain imaging to really understand, well, why is this going on? How does this happen?
And I understand that that actually works best when it's music that the patient really likes.
Absolutely. And when you ask...
So there's that emotional aspect.
That's right. When
well.
You ask Dr. Sprinkle, you know, well, what music does this, he will immediately respond exactly as you did. It's whatever the patient chooses. And that's not, it is, it's sort of a combination of yes, it's, and they're very intermixed. It absolutely does relate to preference and emotional responses, but it also relates to this business of being, and I'll put this in quotes, chemically addicted over a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I once spoke to a psychiatrist who ran a hospital for teenagers. And he told me very clearly that if I bring a teenager into my hospital and I have to take him off hard drugs, he'll go through with physical withdrawal symptoms.
Sure.
If later on I determine that he needs to come off alcohol, he'll go through physical withdrawal symptoms. If I then decide to take him off nicotine, which sometimes is the hardest of the three, he will, again, go through physical withdrawal. But let's suppose that through all this time he's had, quote-unquote, his music, the music that he prefers. And let's suppose that it's music with satanic messages and other things that I have determined are deleterious to his good mental health. And so I now decide to take him off his music. He will go through physical withdrawal very much as he did with hard drugs, with nicotine, and with alcohol. And so through that and from many other ways, we have, again, not so much direct clinical evidence, but certainly some very strong circumstantial evidence that people get addicted. And it doesn't have anything to do, I need to be clear to say, it doesn't have to do with rock music. I'm addicted to Bach and Mozart. I mean, that's the music I love.
Sure.
So it's
you can't live without it.
That's right. It's very clear that the reason we respond so profoundly with tears and overcome to great moments of beauty or power in music is largely because of these chemical responses we're getting. And when you think of large group responses, imagine when Princess Diana died and Elton John's Candle in the Wind, you know, helped millions of people express their grief, their loss, their sense of distress in a very, you know, simple song, but it had very powerful ramifications.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and, you know, I think we've all experienced undoubtedly many a time the physical manifestation of being moved by a particular piece of music. You get goosebumps, chill down the spine.
And in fact, that's probably why music has persisted in human experience through, you know, thousands of years. One of the things that...
Music may well predate language, I'm sure.
Well, and we do have some very strong evidence, and that's a controversial point, whether it predates or... And there are definitely some scholars who do feel that it does, but it's difficult to put that together. But certainly, we have a lot of evidence about the ancient roots of human musicality. Yella Atama is actually a marine biologist at Boston University, but he was part of our wild music exhibit scientific team, because he's a Paleolithic flute specialist. That is, he's an excellent flutist. He studied with Jean-Pierre Rampal.
Mm-hmm.
But he specializes in looking at these old bone flutes that have been discovered. As you can imagine, most ancient musical instruments were biodegradable because they were made out of leather, like a drum, or wood.
Sure.
And so these bone flutes, he's discovered one. Well, one was discovered that he has studied, that has been carbon dated at 53,000 years old.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And although, again, it's controversial, some people think it's just that the holes drilled, which he claims are finger holes, were just a bite of a carnivore.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, I could play you a recording of some beautiful music he plays. We don't know, of course, what it would have sounded like 50,000 years ago. But we could play you that music, which again, brings us back to the brain, because it says two things very clearly. First of all, this notion that music making or any of the arts come after the important things of life have been taken care of and we now have leisure moments is nonsense, because we find art, every time you find anything, any evidence of human beings, you find evidence of art and music. So that 53,000 years ago, when you're still basically trying to survive, it was important to do that, first of all. And second of all, this particular flute is not just simply a hollow tube. It's actually what we call a fipple flute. That is, you put a plug in the head joint and drill an air channel. So it's quite a sophisticated, it's like a recorder.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's very much more difficult to control than just a simple bamboo tube.
Sure.
And so that tells us that 53,000 years ago, somebody thought it was important enough to do and had the intelligence and creativity to figure it out. So music and the brain go back, you know, a long, long ways. The cave paintings that many people are familiar with, Lascaux Caves, for example, in France,
right.
They're actually cave paintings all over the world. You find it up in Siberia, you find it down in Australia and so on. And interestingly enough, when you go study those caves, not all, usually it's a series of caves, and not all the caves have paintings in them. And those caves that have the most paintings are precisely those that are acoustically best suited to singing and chanting. So it's very clear that it was a multimedia event.
Sure.
We've got other evidence that suggests there was dancing and singing and music making going on with the painting that's there. Ian Cross, who's at Cambridge University in England, has what he calls his lithographic project. And he's looked at rocks who have been that have been specially carved and chipped and fashioned in such a way to be a set of chimes, if you will. And he actually plays a set of these old rocks.
So that's rock music.
That is absolutely. That's the original rock music. And so, again, we have quite a bit of evidence that the human brain has almost always, not almost, has always been involved in creative actions. And oftentimes, when you mentioned did this come before language, while that's controversial, Darwin, in fact, thought it did. But others think it didn't. But it's very clear that there have been artistic inventions, creations, discoveries, if you will, that did predate the technological use. For example, the kiln, K-I-L-N, which is used to fire clay.
Right.
The oldest kilns have been found that dated 9,000 years before the earliest functional usage, like making bowls and pots to carry water or to preserve grain and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And they were used to make artistic and religious amulets. So you have a little statue and a little figurine and so on. And this technology, there's a lab in San Antonio where I used to live that works for NASA. And they were looking at high-performance test engines. And, of course, heat in an engine is a problem. So they were looking at coating the piston rings and heads with ceramics because they can tolerate heat better. So you've got absolutely cutting-edge modern technology that's thousands and thousands and thousands of years old that was actually invented for artistic purposes. The CD, which we now use as the CD-ROM with photographs and you know encyclopedias and text and all sorts of things, it was invented for musical purposes. And the more CDs that were sold to promote music, the more the technology was driven towards other potential uses. So,
and we're certainly still seeing that progress happening.
Absolutely. So
speak.
the whole business of the brain, and brain potential, doesn't wait for one thing after another. It's you can be busy doing all kinds of things, and it doesn't parcel them out quite the way we do in modern society. So art and music is as old as the human brain.
Absolutely. Well, I want to go back a little bit, Don, to your studies of highly trained and accomplished musicians.
Mm-hmm.
They are a bit of a breed apart. And what have you been able to discover about the activity in their brains? I understand that you refer to them as small muscle athletes.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
Actually, well, that phrase came from a neurologist by the name of Frank Wilson,
okay,
who wrote a wonderful book called Tone Deaf and All Thumbs. If I can digress for just a moment, his daughter was taking piano lessons, and the piano teacher discovered that he was a neurologist, so she asked him one day, well, how is it that we can learn music and play the piano and stuff? And he said, I don't know. So he did a lot of homework and wrote a book about it.
Okay.
He also, and I want to insert this because it ties into this ancient stuff we were just talking about. He wrote another book. He's a hand specialist. And he wrote a book called The Hand. And there's a chapter in there on the evolutionary basis for human musicality, which is quite interesting. But in another chapter, he's talking about the way the hand and the brain co-evolved, that it wasn't one and then the other. Again, they were working together. And he's talking about chipping flints. And we know that flint blades, ancient flint blades, can sometimes be sharper than modern scalpels. And you can imagine if 30,000, 50,000 years ago, somebody's chipping a flint blade, how are they going to know when it's sharp enough? And you might say, well, they would start cutting things. But no, you have to decide beforehand, because if you keep chipping too far and you break it, you've got this razor-thin edge. Well, the way you know when you're getting close is by the sound of it. And so there's a great example of how hearing and a physical action and the brain work together in that particular case to solve a technological problem, but can do exactly the same thing in solving a musical problem.
Sure.
So now if we look at musicians and you say, you know, what have we discovered? One of the first experiments we did was to take professional-level pianists. Now, these were men and women in their late 40s and early 50s, all of whom had a graduate and advanced degree in music and were actively still performing piano. And we asked them to do three things inside a PET scanner. A positron emission tomography is the fancy name.
Mm-hmm.
And one condition was simply to do nothing, that is to put your brain in neutral and just rest. And that, this is one of the earliest examples of that. It was back in the early 90s, and people thought you had to have specific tasks, that if you just ask people to do nothing, that they would be thinking about something or whatever. Turns out, through many, many experiments, that in fact people are pretty good about putting it in neutral and just sort of coasting.
So establishing a baseline.
And you establish baseline, so in that way you're getting the activation of the brain at rest, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ask them to play scales up and down the keyboard, which has a quasi-musical, you know, has limited musicality, but it activates the hands and fingers in a musical sense.
Sure.
And then they played the opening passage of the third movement of the Bach Italian Concerto, which we chose very intentionally because it has a strong independence of the hands. The right and left hands are doing equally difficult things, but they're also not jumping around the keyboard as you would in modern music. And when you do that, and then you subtract the activations of one from the other and see what's quote-unquote left over, there are some very interesting things that we discovered. First of all, there were, in fact, differences in left and right hemispheres between playing Bach and playing scales. That one's a little bit tough to puzzle out. The only thing we've come up with so far is that the right auditory cortex or temporal lobe was more activated in the Bach, and because of the emotionality content of Bach compared to the scales, it's likely that that might be at least one of the potential reasons to begin to look at.
Mm-hmm.
But two of the other things we found out very clearly. One is that the auditory cortex and the cerebellum were very definitely cross-talking. That is, the right auditory cortex and the left cerebellum were very much involved in a pathway connection. And now that makes perfectly good sense to musicians because it makes sense that what you hear informs what you do. But nobody had ever demonstrated it in the brain before. The cerebellum had long been known as a motor timing, you know, planning, executing part of the brain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it turns out it's much more sophisticated than that. Ours was one of the earliest, but not the earliest, but one of the earliest ones, and there have been several since that show that the cerebellum actually, and in many respects, it's still the black box. We know the least about it than any other part of the brain, but what they're learning is that it's a multi-sensory integration unit where you take in, you know, things from the eyes, the ears, etc., and put it together into an output system. So again, for musicians, what you hear, what you see, and what you're feeling in the hands or the other parts of the body very clearly must come together at some point in order for you to do musically. In this case, they were playing the piano, but it would be true of virtually anything else. So it made good sense. Now, that's an example where intuitively going in, yeah, that's probably how it works, and we found some evidence that supports that.
Sure.
One of the most shocking things was something that completely contradicted anything we would have, at least that I hypothesized. Of course, you do good research by creating a hypothesis, then you go in, test it out, and did it work or not. Well, one of my hypotheses going in was that the frontal lobes of the brain of a performing musician would be very highly activated. Frontal lobes have been implicated in critical thinking, decision-making, long-term planning, judgment, those sorts of things. And so because of, you know, my impression that music is of highly intellectual involvement and so on, well, that'll be really turned on. Well, when we started looking at the first couple of subjects, it was very clearly deactivated, that it was much less active than it was at rest.
Mm-hmm.
So it was essentially turned off.
Right, right.
And initially that was very puzzling. But about a week or two after we were scratching our heads trying to figure this out, Yo-Yo Ma came to town and he was playing a recital. And of course I was involved and enjoying it, but the back of my head was kind of puzzling out. And I thought, why would that be? And here would be my explanation, which again is always speculative because we have to have more evidence to ferret this out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Yo-Yo Ma or any accomplished musician, our pianists as well, have spent a lifetime training the small muscles that you spoke about, so they are now small muscle athletes. So the hands and the fingers, or for a singer, the larynx, the brass player, the lips and the tongue, and so on, these small body muscles have been trained to do these incredibly intricate things for many, many years. And at the moment of execution is not the time to think about it. Right. It's basically the time to get the brain out of the way and let the body do what it's been trained to do. So that oftentimes in the teaching studio, we use a phrase called paralysis by analysis. That when you think about it, you're not able to do it as well. Athletes have the same sort of concept.
Athletes call it being in the zone.
That's right. Sure. Mm-hmm. Now, I will say very quickly that our experiment, of necessity, of course, is in a lab with all kinds of equipment and things hooked up and so on. So the on the
it's hard
stage,
to get the brain out of the way when you're sitting in a PET scan.
That's right. So, you know, I can't pretend that we know exactly what happens when Yo-Yo Ma is on stage in a real musical event, because in fact, if you now think, let's say, of a string quartet, where the first violin plays a phrase and then the second violin has to answer, and so he has to match vibrato rate, has to match the dynamic level, has to match the bow speed. Clearly, there's thinking going on.
Sure.
But it's not the kind of thinking that says, well, how do I do this? Mm-hmm. You know, I've got a shift coming up. How does that happen? Or I can't remember that tough patch. You know, it's again, when you practice and can do it, you get out of the way and let your body do it. So that was one of the... It was one of the most interesting things that we discovered something that's going on in the brains of a performing musician.
Well, you know, that sounds very much like a meditative state almost. Have you done any comparisons between these types of imagings and the imaging studies that have been done, you know, recently with yogis, for example?
No, I haven't. We have not done that, and I've not seen anybody who has, but that would make a terribly interesting study to pursue. That's one of the difficulties, as you well know, that when you do any study, you get more questions than you do answers, and there simply isn't yet enough money or enough time. When we first started doing this, there were several other labs around the world, but not very many people. It wasn't thought to be a terribly important thing to do. And something else that's made a huge difference is that in the earliest days, the MRI, fMRI, and PET, all these imaging tools were used for clinical purposes, so that you know, to spend time and money doing it, studying something like music, seemed to be not appropriate.
Sure.
And it was only until they began to develop separate facilities such that, because in the earliest days when people began to do this work, they would have to schedule subjects late at night or on the weekends. And if the ambulance came screaming in, you had to get out of the way because clearly it was life or death situation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where I was in San Antonio, they had a separate building called the Research Imaging Center, with all the bells and whistles, but solely devoted to research. And that's what we also have at Wake Forest School of Medicine. It's not a separate building, but it's a separate wing.
I see.
Where they have access to these research tools, not for clinical purposes, but for research purposes. And that gives you an enormous flexibility and power that we didn't have many years ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the tools are just now improving so much. I'll give you another example. PET is highly advantageous because it's totally silent, so you can do things like music without the confound of noise, but you have to introduce radioactive tracer to the subject, which does two things. First of all, there are some subjects who will not participate, even though medically and clinically it's not a hazard.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, you're very much limited on how many trials you can do in a given period of time. Conversely, MRI and fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, and I'll just say very quickly. PET is very good for function, but not very good for location because it's kind of fuzzy.
Mm-hmm.
MRI is really good for location, but not good at function. But functional MRI now gives you, in essence, the best of both worlds because you can track the function of the brain, which is really blood flow because it's delivering the oxygen, which is the fuel for the brain cells.
Sure. I know fMRI has been a major breakthrough.
Right. It's a huge breakthrough, but it's incredibly noisy. If you've ever had an MRI, the camera in there is going around, and it has a pounding, bop, 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 bop. It's a very driving sound. And so, obviously, when you introduce music, you got a confound there.
Kind of take you off your game.
The earliest researchers who started using that technique said, well, we use it for both the musical condition and the contrast condition, and so we subtract that out. But clearly it is a confound. But now, in recent years at Wake Forest and other labs around the world, they've discovered a way to stop the camera and have what's called a silent acquisition period. It's now off to about 10 or 12 seconds where you can introduce a stimulus, and you act, you know, subject begins to work on this problem, whatever you've given them, then the camera starts up again, and what it's really doing is measuring again the blood flow. And so the, since there's a time lag between the beginning of working on a problem and the blood flowing to that part of the brain, they can actually capture the entire envelope, particularly if they jitter the acquisition, so it starts and stops at slightly different places, 10 and a half seconds, 11 seconds, etc. Then they can build the entire envelope of the blood flow response to the given problem. So the tools are just getting better and better and better, and you know, that's going to continue to happen.
That's fascinating. Don, what about different types of musicians? And I'll, if you care to speculate on this, because this probably isn't something you've studied directly, but just something I'm certainly curious mm-hmm. about. Do you think imaging studies from, say, Thelonious Monk, Glenn Gould, Fats Domino, all pianists,
right?
Do you think they would look substantially different, or even, you know, musicians on different instruments that have different skill sets, mm-hmm. such as you talked about, such as wind versus stringed, or single note versus corded instruments.
Uh-huh.
Have you looked at anything like that?
No, we have not, although it's been, people have asked that pretty frequently. The very first study we did, as I said, involved pianists, and immediately somebody said, well, what about somebody who's improvising rather than playing, you know, composed piece? And we did have access to some brilliant improvisation folks. But, again, time and money. So, sure. Absolutely, it would be speculative. And the easy answer to the question is yes and no. That is, clearly, there, by logic and by, you know, the information that we do have, there are many, many shared things about music making that all musicians would be engaged in some respect. So rhythmic and pitch processing, et cetera, et cetera. But clearly, virtually every musical expertise... you know, if you think, instead of your three examples, a little bit closer for a moment, think of a jazz drummer who has to coordinate both hands and feet. The only other people I know are organists who are doing both hands, both feet. So jazz drummers and organists might be more similar than, let's say, an organist and a flute player.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So clearly we would see some differences in that regard. But going back to your three examples, if we can have refined enough measurements... And in some cases, we are getting closer to that. In others, we may not be able to do that yet. I certainly do think we would begin to tease apart, or eventually we certainly will be able to tease apart, this business of improvising as opposed to doing a memorized piece. And a couple of things that would suggest that. Clearly, as we were just talking about, this business of letting the body get out of the way and do what you've been trained to do, when you've memorized a particular piece of music with very prescribed set, you know, physical motions, motor patterns, right, like playing Bach,
mm-hmm.
Clearly, you know, get out of the way and let your brain do it. If you're creating music on the fly, obviously there must be a very different mental activity, although clearly those jazz aficionados who really know the music of Thelonious Monk can recognize his style. Why? Because he's calling upon familiar patterns so that the combination at any given moment in time may be unique, but over a time you would see his particular stylistic traits coming over and over. So he's sure. not making it up from scratch, of course. He's calling upon stored memories and motor patterns. Again, the cerebellum stores habituated things like your signature, for example. If I ask you to sign your name, you don't think about how to do that. If you ask a three-year-old, they would take a crayon and grab it in a power grip and sort of laboriously trace letters. But now your signature is an automatic response. Well, likewise, Thelonious Monk presumably has habituated hundreds, if not thousands, of these little tiny bits and pieces of rhythm and pitch patterns, which he can miraculously, or at least it seems that way, call in some almost endless permutation of combinations. Mm-hmm. But if you heard him play the same tune five different times over a period of, let's say, 10 years, you would see and hear, I would imagine, some consistent threads, some common ways of doing some things that would separate him from Dizzy Gillespie or from other jazz artists.
And certainly artists like that, certainly the ones that are among my favorites are the ones that have that instantly recognizable authority.
Now, another thing another aspect of this that would come into play is that in the late 70s, early 80s, sometimes you would read about music in the right side of your brain or the music center. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we've clearly debunked, and when I say we, I mean all of music neuroscientists, that music is left and right and front and back and top and bottom. It's all over the brain, to the point that some of the premier neuroscientists in the world who originally were skeptics. One of my colleagues in San Antonio was a neuroscientist by the name of Larry Parsons. And Larry, when the National Science Foundation set up the cognitive neuroscience branch and gave it a $100 million budget, Larry was named the first director. So you can imagine he probably knew something about the brain.
Absolutely.
And Larry was, if not a skeptic, certainly, you know, very quizzical about all this in the earliest days. But I have heard him say categorically in a room full of neuroscientists that we can't find anything that so strongly activates the brain in so many different places as music. One of the very earliest studies done by a neuroscientist by the name of Masiotta out in California in the early 80s, he states in his article, I would be hard-pressed to name a part of the brain that didn't activate during a musical, you know, strong musical experience. So you know, when you think about calling upon motor systems, and that's true both for performers and listeners, so you're tapping your toe and you're nodding your head and your body is swaying. So motor systems, memory systems, emotional systems, cognitive analytic systems, auditory systems, visual systems. I mean, there are so many parts of the brain. And of course, in many, many cases, language is involved when you're singing a song,
right?
In opera or pop music, whatever.
Or reading notes.
Or, you know, the aspect of reading music, which I'll come back to in just a second. But clearly, it's just all over the brain. Now, that doesn't make it better or anything of the sort, but what it does mean is that musicians, by virtue of their long-term training, have configured the brain in such a way that it cooperates within itself, both within hemispheres and between the two, such that Helmut Petschy did some work in Vienna a number of years ago looking at what are called coherence values, and these are EEG traces looking at not just the EEG waves, but how the different places in the brain, typically when you do EEG, you have a map of electrodes on the brain, which they've identified. And so what they did was look at how each of these different brain sites were cooperating with it. So the occipital lobe with the parietal lobe with the temporal lobe with the frontal lobe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what they found is that musicians, compared to untrained, even sitting there at rest, not doing a musical task, showed very high coherence values. That is, the brain was cooperating with itself to a much greater degree than the untrained. So I think that's what we would see. And going back to your example of the three artists, we would see huge interactions involving all sorts of places in the brain, but the actual patterns would probably be differentiated such that not only different kinds of music making, popular music and classical music and jazz and so on, but different jazz artists, different classical artists and so on, such that Glenn Gould, you mentioned, was a very particular kind of classical artist. I mean, any, you know, experienced musician could identify his style almost immediately, and so clearly that would be evidenced by a particular pattern. Mm-hmm. Now, we're a long way away from getting at that, although a guy by the name Manfred Kleins did some very creative work in which he had trained musicians push on a little button, as it were, hooked up to a strain gauge, and he could monitor up and down pressure and forwards and backwards. And he had people like Pablo Casals and Rudolf Serkin, I mean, world-class musicians, simply think of particular composers like Bach and Mozart and Brahms, Beethoven, and lo and behold, the tracings that they pushed, which came out in a computer rendering of a two-dimensional pattern, were absolutely identical. So you could easily tell which was Bach, which was Mozart, which was Chopin once you'd done enough of these.
Yeah,
to the point where when Rudolf Serkin came into the lab and Manfred Kleins said, I want you to push on this gauge and imagine that you're listening to Beethoven. So he left him alone, and they're supposed to press several hundred times in order to get enough tracing. And after about 30 or 40 pressings, Kleins came back in the room and stopped him and said, no, you're thinking of Bach, and I asked you to think of Beethoven. And it was true. Serkin was trying to trick him because he didn't believe it. He thought this was this little nonsense. Now, you know, this is a little, again, controversial. It almost sounds New Agey, but it does suggest, and we got a lot of work yet to do, that that the patterns you find in music and the patterns you find in the brain itself and the patterns you find in individual given musicians who are creating this music, somehow there has to be some linkages to all these.
Sure.
And it won't be as simple as saying, we'll contrast that with the Music Make You Smarter stuff, where the theory was that the firing patterns of Mozart resembled the firing patterns in certain parts of the brain, therefore if you listen to Mozart, you become smarter. No, don't think so. Right. Not that simplistically. But I don't think that means that there isn't some deeper underlying rhythmicity connecting all of these things.
I see. And that's just fascinating. And all of these studies that you've been telling us about are just amazing. You've learned so much, and obviously there's a great deal left to learn. So maybe
we can
do this again in a couple of years.
All right.
But before we run out of time, Don, I wanted to ask you, I know that ultimately you are a music educator.
Mm-hmm.
Do the findings you've been describing have any implications for how or when music is taught? Does this speak back to music education itself?
Yes, it certainly does, although we're not quite at the most direct application that we would want. There is a study going on right now. Gottfried Schlaug and Ellen Winter and some others up in Boston are doing exactly this kind of a study, where they did a brain imaging of students before they started taking music lessons, and some who are not, and then once a year they're doing brain imaging studies to track their progress, of course, across a couple of years. So that will be very interesting. But certainly the fact that all human beings are musical, and that we can demonstrate that neurologically, that's an obvious thing,
mm-hmm.
That we can begin to demonstrate some of these linkages and changes in the brain and what kind of implications those have for learning. Although, again, I'll be clear to say I do not believe that studying music necessarily makes you smarter in that simplistic way. But I do, I will say that there's a mid-ground position, and we do have evidence that children who study music do better on verbal learning tasks, for example. They do better on some spatial temporal reasoning tasks. There are some evidences that there's some crossover. We've got a long way to go before we can really demonstrate clearly. And what we don't ever want to suggest is the reason a child should study music is so that they'll do better in language or math.
Sure.
Studying music has its own value, but there's no reason why it can't not only have its own value, but its transfer values. But we have a lot of work to do before we can say that more strongly.
I see. Well, it sounds like just like we know that the earlier you start a child learning a foreign language, the better it's going to be in adult years.
Sure.
I would assume that some of this research is kind of confirming the Suzuki type of approach, where you're starting kids off learning music and learning how to
sure.
play an instrument very early.
Absolutely, it does. Although, again, there's sort of a parallel, a contrasting version. But yes, the earlier you start, the more likely you are to be successful at it, and the more implications it has for brain development. Human beings don't seem to have a critical period in the same sense that animals do, where if you don't do it in this period of time, it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But we have optimal periods, certainly, and language is a good example, that if you grow up bilingual, you're likely to be much more facile than if I, at my age, started learning to speak Polish, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there's a group of nuns who are living in retirement in their 70s, 80s, and 90s who willed their brains to science, are being studied rigorously, and then their brains are autopsied at death. And it's basically use it or lose it. And
right.
the more education you had in early ages, the better off you'll stave off the cognitive dementias. And music is one of the things they tell older adults to do. So, you know, if a 70-year-old person begins to take piano lessons for the very first time, they'll probably not likely play piano the way they would if they'd started when they were seven. But they still can learn. The brain still can adapt and grow and learn at any age. But you're right. There are definitely optimal periods, and certainly early childhood is the time to begin.
Well, Don, we are out of time for the hour already, and Dr. Donald Hodges, it has been absolutely fascinating to hear about all the important work you and your colleagues are doing at the Music Research Institute, and thanks again for coming all the way from Greensboro.
It's today. My pleasure.
And we've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio En Vivo. You can check the website, radioenvivo.net, and we certainly hope you will listen again and support WCOM-FM, Carrboro, and Chapel Hill. See you next time.